Ms. Gonzalez. Ms. Campagnoli?
Yes. Good morning, good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Susan Campagnoli on behalf of the petitioner, Nahar Dababneh. Mr. Dababneh is a native and citizen of Jordan. He came to the United States in June 1993. He's lived here ever since that date. He is married. In addition to his extended family, he has two United States citizen children. He's not been convicted of any offense. His appeal to this court involves the sufficiency of the charging document, the notice to appear, that the Department of Homeland Security used when it initiated removal proceedings against him in 2003. Specifically, he's saying that because the notice to appear did not contain all of the information required by Section 239, the immigration court lacked jurisdiction over his case. And second, he's saying even if the court had jurisdiction, because the notice to appear did not comport in every way with the statute, it did not serve to cut off the accrual of his physical presence for purposes of cancellation of removal. When the document was served, he was 43 days short of the 10 years he needed in order to be able to apply for that benefit. The notice to appear is a charging document, and it's crucial in the statutory and regulatory scheme governing commencement of removal proceedings. The government must not only issue and serve the notice to appear, it must then file it with the immigration court. The statute and the regulations anticipate what I would call a seamless document, a document that on its face contains all of the information an individual needs to know. The specific legal charge, the factual assertions to support that charge, the individual's rights and responsibilities, the right to be represented by counsel, where and when the proceedings will be held, the need to keep the court informed of an address change, and the absolute requirement to appear at proceedings. And I would argue that this information intersects with the obligations. In other words, one must keep the court informed of one's address, but one needs to know where the court is. One knows that one has to appear, but one needs to know where and when the proceedings are going to be held. Now, the regulations regarding the time and place of hearing, the regulations, in fact, give the government a safety valve, which says that if it's not practicable to include this information in one document, the immigration court can later supplement the notice to appear by sending a separate notice with that information. But the regulation is clear that the government has to show that it's not practicable to include everything in one document. The government didn't do that here. The government here makes essentially two arguments, that the failure to include this information was merely technical, and second, that in any event, the petitioner didn't suffer harm. And I would argue to this court that the information is more than merely technical. The information is in the statute. It's part of the statutory scheme. It's part of the regulatory scheme. It has to mean something. And the government cannot take it on itself to go through the statute and decide which requirements are merely technical and which requirements it will respect. And second, the petitioner did suffer prejudice because the hasty issuance of the notice to appear meant that he was served really before the government was ready to go forward, and thus cutting off accrual of his physical presence. The petitioner's second argument is that even if this court is inclined to grant the government some leeway in letting them combine the two documents, even without the required regulatory showing that it's not practicable to put it in one document, even if that's the case, I would urge this court, or the petitioner argues, that Section 239 needs to be read differently when it cuts off accrual of physical presence. This is because this is an ameliorative benefit. It is something that has been, it's a benefit that's been in the immigration law since we've started proceedings, since we've had proceedings to remove people from the United States in one form or another. If service of the charging document does not comply with the statute in every way, it cannot cut off accrual of physical presence. I think the statute is pretty plain there, and the statute has to mean what it says. And I think such a reading is entirely consistent with recent board cases interpreting this provision, the stop time rule, the rule that cuts off accrual of physical presence. Two recent cases have said that even after service of the notice to appear, an individual continues to accrue equities. In other words, you get the notice to appear, you have a child born, you get married. That all continues. That's not in the statute. That's a generous reading that the board has chosen to give the stop time rule. Second, another recent case decided by the board is that interprets service of a notice to appear and holds that someone can be served with a notice to appear, have proceedings, be removed, come back, and then start to accrue time all over again. Again, that's something that's not in the statute. It's if you will, a generous reading of the stop time rule. And I would encourage this court, or I would suggest that such a reading as petitioner is asking here is entirely consistent with the statute and with the history of this provision and with those recent board cases. Finally, I think the question then becomes if time for accrual of physical presence isn't cut off with service of the faulty notice to appear, when is it cut off? One could argue it's cut off when the individual actually does appear in court. Petitioner would encourage this court to take an interpretation that the government actually suggests, which is that if the government chooses not to serve a seamless document, the notice to appear containing all of the information, then time stops accruing when the issue is removed from controversy. In other words, when there is a finding of removability, that would be the time at which the physical presence stops accruing. And I notice my light is on.
If an attorney appeared and asked for a continuance of 30 or 60 days, what would we do with that kind of case? As far as accepting your proposal, do we reward or add that? How would we handle that kind of a case?
Well, I mean, I would suggest that the government in the first instance has the discretion whether it wants to put itself in that position because it can include all the information in a notice to appear. And if it chooses not to do it, often the case is continued for investigation into whether there's relief, and the immigration judge will commonly take a, I shouldn't say commonly, but will often take a pleading at the initial master calendar and then continue the case to determine, well, can you apply for adjustment of status? Is your priority date current? The government is missing a conviction record, plead to this charge, and we'll give them time to get the documents they need. So I don't think that what we're suggesting really leaves the whole scheme open to abuse because it really is in the control of the government in the first instance what they include in the notice to appear. And in the second instance, if the government's ready to go forward, the government can press the immigration judge to make a finding of removability and still grant a continuance.
Well, the tolling of time, suppose one receives not the complete notice as you would describe it, and just chooses been alerted to something, but maybe not the date and address. So that person just does nothing. So would you say it kind of actually avoids making any inquiry of where the office might be or the court might be? So would we be rewarding that individual inappropriately by just perhaps neglecting to do anything? As far as building the time toward the...
Well, no, I don't think so, Your Honor, because the statute and regulations actually require the government to then inform the individual of where and when the proceedings will take place. So in terms of rewarding the individual, no, I don't think so. If the government initiates proceedings before it's ready to go forward, I don't really see that as being a reward for the individual. Okay, thank you.
Bernstein.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. I am Josh Bronstein for the Attorney General. Petitioner in this case does not he concedes that he remained in the United States illegally for more than 9 years, and he does not contend that he is not removable from the United States. What he has done is, when he found himself being charged with his ongoing immigration violation, he found that he was just short of the 10 years of physical presence required for his eligibility to apply for cancellation of removal. And so he apparently scrambled to create a loophole for himself. But this argument has been raised before, and the Eighth Circuit has not very long ago addressed the very issue. The Eighth Circuit called the same argument nonsense in the Hyder case, and the Court noted that there's nothing unlawful about the Department of Homeland Security filing or charging the alien and by issuing him a notice to appear, and then later the regulations not only authorize but require the Immigration Court, which is a separate body, to set the date and time and place of hearings, authorizing it to do so. The Court said there is nothing unlawful about this conduct. And indeed, in this case, petitioner can show nothing unlawful about this conduct. His argument really does turn on the regulation, but he kind of ignores the regulations, which he must do because he never addressed or challenged the regulations in his proceeding below. And so he, as we noted in our brief, he didn't exhaust his challenge to the regulation. The safety valve argument and the practicable argument that he makes today is not properly before this Court. And indeed, in his brief to the Board of Immigration Appeals, he very carefully avoids delving into the regulations and notes that his argument is statutory. In the record at page 9, he talks about how the immigration judge in her decision denying his motion to terminate proceedings, that she referred to regulations, and he puts the word regulations in quotation marks, and then he says, without citation. And then he gets back to his statutory argument. What petitioner wants is either a new reading of the statute, which finds no support in the law, that says, even though the regulations permit you to later provide the date and time of your hearing, the Court should ignore that and just find that the statute on its face, if that information is not in the notice to appear, then it is defective to the point of denying the Immigration Court jurisdiction over his case. There is no support in the law for that. And again, he has not even raised before the Court, or rather before the agency, this argument. But I want to point out that even if he had, he would be even in worse shape, because the operative regulation referring to scheduling of cases at 8 CFR 1003.18, letter A, he's never mentioned at any time, but it says very clearly, the Immigration Court shall be responsible for scheduling cases and providing notice to the government and the alien of the time, place, and date of hearings. And then it goes on to note the language. So this is an obligation of the Immigration Court under the regulations which he never challenged below. And indeed, with the Court in this case discharged that obligation very soon after the notice to appear was filed. So I want to get back briefly and just touch on his argument, which he says characterizes as a hasty issuance of the notice to appear without the time and date. Now, even looking right at his argument, which he says in his brief, one may assume that this is page 15 of his brief, one may assume that had the government taken the extra time to properly prepare and file the notice to appear, petitioner may well have had the required physical presence. We mistakenly refer to that argument as speculative in our brief. It's not speculative. It's demonstrably incorrect because of the timing of what transpired. By his own assertion, he's either, at different times, he's either 43 or 47 days shy of the 10 years of physical presence when he's served with the notice to appear. I think that it's 47 days, but it doesn't matter in the end. He was charged, and these are the uncontested facts, I think. He was served on April 14th, 2003. This all goes back to his hastily issued argument. Now, something like, and it said all the information was in the notice to appear, which he doesn't contest, except that it said the date to be set. The place was in there. It told him he had to come to the immigration court in Chicago, and it gave the address, and it merely excluded that and that exact time and date, and it said to be set. Well, 2 weeks later, on May 1st, the notice to appear was filed in immigration court, and the record reflects this. The next day, May 2nd, the immigration court sent petitioner a notice of hearing, setting the time and date. On May 23rd, he appeared in immigration court and then asked for a lawyer and a continuance to get a lawyer. Now, this is critical to his hastily issued argument, because all of those things happened before he would have otherwise been eligible for cancellation of removal. They all happened within 39 days. He was still shy of the 10 years of physical presence necessary. Now, he wants that date to be moved out into the future. And again, although there's no basis for moving it at all, there's no basis for not applying the stop time rule, because that statute is as clear and unambiguous as statutes get. But even if one did, if for some reason, say, all right, this hastily issued argument has some weight. Well, it doesn't, because it still doesn't get him what he wants. But again, of course, there's no support in the law for that argument anyway. The stop time rule at 8 U.S.C. section 1229 B.D.I. says any period of continuous presence in the United States shall be deemed to end when the alien is served a notice to appear under section 1229A of this title. Now, he concedes that maybe since he did go to immigration court and later concede that he was removable, which this court has addressed in the Qureshi case as cutting off his relief in any event, that maybe it should have two different meanings, that phrase, when the alien is served with a notice to appear. Well, of course, the presumption of uniform usage does not yield in a case where a phrase is used and there is absolutely no reason to believe that it was meant to mean two different things. And so I think with that, I think that the court should summarily deny this petition for review, and unless the court has any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll be brief. Counsel cites the Eighth Circuit. I mean, the First Circuit, of course, gave the argument careful consideration in Latu, and the District Court has also treated the argument with respect. In regards to the hastily issued argument, that really goes towards the first prong. Is there jurisdiction? Because this Court has held that there must be prejudice if the court is going to act on a statutory or regulatory violation. But counsel really does not address the argument as to why the provision cannot have a separate meaning in the stop time rule as in the initiation of proceedings. There really isn't any reason that the court cannot view the two provisions differently. If the court is reluctant to apply a strict statutory interpretation to to Section 239 and the jurisdictional argument. And counsel claims that the stop time rule is clear and unambiguous. Well, that really cuts both ways, because it does say that the NTA has to be served in compliance with Section 239. It's really a circular argument, and it wasn't served in compliance with Section 239. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will stand in recess.